The court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Our third and final case for the day, Daniel versus Arms List. Before we begin, you'll notice the chair to my right is empty. Justice Shirley Abraham's son generally sits there. She is not participating in this case, so she's not at oral argument and she won't be participating in the decision conference that will follow. With that brief announcement, are you ready to proceed? Please do so.
May it please the court. Daniel's claims against Arms List should remain dismissed because they are preempted by Section 230 of the Federal Communications Decency Act. Section 230 is squarely rooted in a value we all share, the freedom of speech, what Justice Robert Jackson called the one fixed star in our constitutional constellation. This value is granted first position in the Bill of Rights and represents a hallowed societal consensus transcending the facts of individual cases and providing a guiding light even in tragic cases like this one.
Counsel, could we start with this, and let's get down to the specifics. At page 9 of your brief, you said in undertaking this, and I'll insert, plain meaning analysis, which the parties had not briefed, the court, referring to the Court of Appeals, noted at the outset that it did not intend to look to the significant body of federal and state case law interpreting the CDA, which it said does not significantly aid in the analysis. And I'm wondering, why didn't you brief a plain meaning analysis of the statute that you're relying on?
In the Court of Appeals, we briefed our arguments based on the body of case law that had developed interpreting the CDA since the Zeron case in 1997.
Yeah, but we always start with the statutory language, right?
Yes, and we don't disagree that the court should do so here as well. Our position is that the Court of Appeals did not, in fact, conduct a plain language interpretation when it said it was doing so, including because it started with a very narrowing construction of the statutory language at issue, but also because it didn't follow a number of the provisions of the statute, including its preamble and certain terms like speaker and publisher that do have meaning here.
So let's do this. Can you give me your best textual analysis of the statute that would support your position?
Certainly. I'm going to grab a copy of the statute. So we're in Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, and specifically we're at subsection C1 of that section. The subsection is entitled Treatment of Publisher or Speaker. It says, no provider or user of an interactive computer service, here that's Arms List, shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. Here, the information content providers are the third-party users of armslist.com. Both interactive computer service and information content provider are defined in subsections F2 and F3 of the statute. There's no dispute in the case that ArmsList is an information content, interactive computer service, rather, and there's no dispute in the case that its third-party users are information content.
And is there any dispute that, with respect to that third-party information, Arms List was acting as a publisher or a speaker?
No, there's no dispute about that either. Okay. The real dispute in this case seems to be whether Daniel's claims treat Arms List as a publisher or speaker or not. The parties generally agree on what the law is. They agree that the Communications Decency Act prohibits claims that do treat ArmsList as a publisher or speaker of third-party information. And so the question here is narrow. It's simply whether Daniel's claims, in fact, do that. And they do. The critical question is, do Daniel's claims treat ArmsList as a publisher of third-party content by holding it liable for providing public access to the information its third-party users post on the site?
I think the issue is different than you set it up. I look at the same, of course, section of the federal code as you do. But to me, I would draw your attention to Parent E3, which says the term information content provider means any person or entity that is responsible in whole or in part for the creation or development of information provided through the internet and any interactive computer service. I think what they are saying is that your client is responsible for the development. And the question here is whether the system that is set up, that is interactive, so it's set up by ArmsList so that people can put things into it and read things, access it, whether that's development. Okay? And I thought that's where the fuss was.
I would agree with that framing. And it, in a way, it's the other side of the same coin, because
I was just looking at the word, because I know Justice Kelly wanted you to look at the words in the statute.
Yes.
Me
so,
too, in fact. But.
So I believe the parties agree that to the extent ArmsList is an information content provider because it develops content and not an interactive computer service, the CDA does not provide immunity. So the question is ArmsList a developer of content because of how its website is structured? We agree.
Right.
Now, if the court looks at the very narrow and small number of cases where courts reject a CDA defense on that basis, they do so applying what's called the material contribution test. This is a test that came out of the Ninth Circuit in a case involving roommates.com, where it was alleged that the website was constructed in a way that required its users to submit information that was per se unlawful because it was discriminatory in nature. The users of roommates.com had to fill out a form indicating things like gender and sexual orientation. And those categories of information are prohibited by the Fair Housing Act. You couldn't ask them if you were renting to a tenant. It's no different online. And so the problem in roommates.com was the platform operator itself constructed a website, including forms on the website,
Council,
that required unlawful activity.
Yeah, before you go too far down that, and that will be, I think, an instructive road to follow in a moment, I'd like to have you finish setting the table for us. So going back to the words of the statute, we're asking whether you should be treated as a publisher or speaker of this third-party information. And my understanding is that publisher or speaker is significant because if you're not a publisher or speaker, if you're just hosting information provided by third parties on a website, you're already immune, right? If you're acting as a utility, other people are just posting information on your website, you're not interacting with it, that is to say, you're not acting as a publisher with respect to that information, you're not liable for that information on your website, is that right?
Well, you're not liable because you're not a publisher. You're not liable for claims that would treat you as a publisher of that information.
I understand that's what the CDA says, but
absent the CDA, yes.
I want you to back up and look at this a little bit more broadly, right? So we start before the CDA is adopted, right?
Yes.
And you have a website that is just has third-party information on it. The website and the website owner doesn't interact with that information at all. It's just posted there on the screen. My understanding is they're immune from liability with respect to that third-party information, because they're not interacting with it. They're not acting as a publisher, correct?
All right. Yes, I'm with you so far.
All right. So then the CDA becomes effective when you do start interacting with that information in a way that makes you a publisher, yes?
If you're disseminating the information via the Internet, yes.
All right. Well, let's tighten that up a little bit. So what does it take for a website to be functioning as a publisher with respect to the information provided by third parties on that website?
It needs to be making that information, disseminating that information to the public.
Without interacting with it? Correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding is that if you are essentially a utility, a telephone, one of the reasons you can't be held liable for what people say over the telephone is because you're not a publisher of the information that's over the telephone, right?
Right. So I think where the confusion comes in is the CDA, codifies a protection for publishers of third-party information. That protection is broad enough to encompass doing nothing with the information. It doesn't require a heightened level of activity.
I'm not sure that's true.
Okay.
Well, the immunity begins when you're doing nothing. Then you start doing something with the data on the website, and then the CDA kicks in to provide immunity, notwithstanding the fact that you're acting as a publisher.
Is that a question, Justice Kelly?
I want to see if he agrees with that.
Usually in my territory, we say, and so?
and question mark?
My understanding of the backdrop of the law against which the CDA was enacted was that there may have been liability for doing nothing, merely serving as a conduit for information, just as newspapers post classified ads from all comers. And the concern of Congress was that that type of potential liability would stifle the Internet if it were allowed to be transferred online. So the purpose of the Communication Decency Act was, in fact, to make clear that conduits of information are not liable, but also that if you exercise traditional publisher functions, such as providing a platform for speech, editing content to minimal degree, and so forth, you don't somehow become liable in a way that you weren't by doing nothing.
Isn't by its nature a website not really a traditional publisher function, and isn't that really the crux of this here, is what is a publisher? Is there design, which is the allegation that facilitates these illegal sales, is that something that falls within the realm of being a publisher? Or is that something that they did that is outside of that immunity protection? And you started with roommates. There's not a lot of cases that deal with that aspect. Most of it has content, the content piece, most of these cases. So I'd like to hear, well, if you have other cases besides that, but what do you make of the JS case out of Washington? Because that is a case that seems to be more directly on point. We don't have an exactly directly on point case.
I'm sorry, Justice Sally, could you say the case again? I didn't
hear
it.
It's the one out of Washington State. It's JS.
JS?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Versus Village Voice Media.
Yeah, thanks. 184 Wash 2nd, 95.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. There are a couple of things to unpack there. First of all.
Sorry, I thought I'd get it all in. So.
First of all, the websites that disseminate information provided by third parties are acting just as a print publisher would, to the extent they don't cross some line that takes them out of that protection. And I think here the question is really, has ArmsList crossed that line? And the Chief Justice Rogensack's question about material contribution really gets to that, and that's why I talked about the roommate. The JS media case that Justice Dallet mentioned is another example of that same type of case. It may be helpful if I could zoom out a bit and explain the framework that these cases tend to fall into once you start reading 60 or 70 of them back to back, as I've had the pleasure of doing recently. Really, the only three types of cases where a CDA defense is rejected and liability is imposed are, one, when there is an independent legal duty, such as a promise, that doesn't involve treating the defendant as a publisher. So we see promissory estoppel claims, we see failure to supervise, we see failure to warn. These are all cases where the duty that's alleged by the tort arises independently of the publisher role of the defendant. That's category number one. Category number two are the content creation cases that Justice Dalek referenced, and she is correct. Those are the majority of the cases that, that do find liability and reject that CDA defense. There's really no allegation here that ArmsList created content of its own. The third category of cases is the one that we're discussing, and that is where, by a material contribution to the unlawfulness of the content, the defendant takes itself out of that publisher category and crosses the line into developing the content. And I'll give you a few examples of that to show that it isn't just the roommate's case.
And please, when you do that, tell me how it's why it has to be content. You keep focusing on content, but there's this publisher piece, and I don't know that when you design a website, you're necessarily using content as opposed to perhaps the design is, I mean, the allegation here is that the design facilitated this illegal conduct. That's not necessarily content. So if you can do distinguish that as well, please.
Sure. So to start with some examples of this material contribution theory, in addition to the roommate's case, let's talk about the JS case. That actually fits into that category because if you read the allegations discussed in the Washington Supreme Court's opinion, the plaintiff actually alleged that Backpage required content that would encourage illegal trade through its website. So while the decision goes farther in imposing liability than any others that we've seen, there is a way to square it with this doctrine because of the particular allegations in that plaintiff's complaint. Here are some other examples. There are the two FTC cases that came up in briefing. One is FTC versus AccuSearch, which is a Tenth Circuit case from 2009. The allegation there was that the defendant actively solicited and paid for unlawful content. In that case, it was confidential personal identifying information that the defendant knew shouldn't be exposed, went out and paid for it, and then exposed it on its own website. There's also the FTC v. LeanSpa case out of the District of Connecticut in 2013. The allegation there was that one defendant, LeanSpa, created its own false advertising, which would be content creation, and the other defendant, LeadClick, solicited and paid for fake news sites that linked to the false advertising created by the other defendant. So it was,
again, familiar with Jones versus Dirty World Entertainment? That's a Sixth Circuit case.
Yes.
Okay. I found that very helpful, not just because it focused on the word development, which is what was bothering me as I read the statutes. And, of course, it's a material contribution case. But I thought, for me, the explanation in it was helpful. Sometimes these cases, for me, are almost ipsy-dixit. They don't go through any reasoning. They just come up with a result. But I thought, you know, it's a heartbreaking case. In regard to, it's a defamation case, of course, but I thought that the reasoning of the court in regard to linking together 230C1 and the E3 part that I was concerned about was really helpful.
It is. That case is where the Sixth Circuit adopts this material contribution test that the
right.
Ninth Circuit developed and does a really nice job of tying it to the text of the statute
right, exactly.
in a way that would satisfy a plain language interpretation. And we agree with the analysis in that case. The whole point of the material contribution theory is that by contributing to the development of the content that is unlawful, you become an information content provider
right.
under F3 of the statute, and therefore, by definition, the claims do not treat you as the publisher or speaker of third-party content under C1. Yeah.
Counsel, are you finished?
Yes.
That's essentially, in substance, I think what the Court of Appeals was doing here, but not precisely. You've been discussing the material contribution.
Yes.
But I saw the Court of Appeals going one step farther, although relying on roommates and some of the other cases you just talked about with regard to material contribution, the Washington State case, the JS case, I think. I found this Court of Appeals saying it isn't a matter of material contribution to the content developed by Linz and Radcliffe. Rather, the Court of Appeals, I think, in their analysis, but very pointedly in paragraph 3 of their introduction of their holding, indicate that what we have here is Arms List developing their own content. Now, that's the way I interpreted the Court of Appeals case. Do you see it that way or differently?
It gets a little muddy here because, among other things, the theory of liability has shifted over time as the case progressed. To the extent that either the Court of Appeals or Daniel is alleging that Arms List itself has created content here, the plaintiff has not actually identified any content that Arms List created.
Oh, look at paragraph 64 of the plaintiff's complaint. I take a disagreement with you that the theory has changed. The Court of Appeals opinion in the paragraph 3 that I previously referred to indicate that the theory of liability, they go on to explain it further. But the theory upon which they're advancing, they being the plaintiff or Daniel being the plaintiff, is that the website design, the website was designed to facilitate illegal purchasers. That's the theory of liability upon which the Court of Appeals discussed their case, and that's why I say that they seem to be indicating it's not a material contribution. They developed, Armless developed their own content and therefore are not publishers or speakers of a third-party content because they developed their own. But if you look at paragraph 64, if you probably have it before you, of the complaint, that's exactly what's being asserted, especially A through D, but especially in B.
So the content, if that's the word we're going to use, that the Court of Appeals is pointing to in Daniel 2, are actually the design and operational features of the website, which in CDA parlance is different from content. Content is the information that gets posted. We're talking about how the website works. And those design and operational features, which I agree are listed in paragraph 54 of the complaint.
54, not 64.
So 54 is the list of problematic operating functions, and 63 is the list of additional precautions that Arms List could have adopted. But in any case, those design and operational features are what we call neutral tools in CDA language. And this is what links up with the material contribution test, because material contribution to unlawful content is, in the doctrine, the opposite of neutral tools.
Let me just, for clarification, and you were very good about this, so indulge me. I meant to be referencing paragraph 54, as you, I think, indicated. Just
Would you like me to walk through those pieces? Is that?
No. I know. So, B is the very thing that the Court of Appeals is focusing on with regard to paragraph 3 of their opinion and their analysis.
So B is the search function that allows users to filter for or look exclusively for private sales. We need to be careful here because that is not unlawful. Private sales of guns in Wisconsin are legal. The only time that a private sale of a gun in Wisconsin is illegal is if you intentionally make a sale of a firearm to someone you know is not allowed to possess it. So that function by itself is a lawful tool that is predominantly used for lawful purposes, but could be abused if someone is looking to break the law. That is the definition of a neutral tool under the CDA.
What about the Washington State case? Didn't that also deal with the function, if you will?
The Washington State case was another design and operational features case, but there the court found that the features required unlawfulness, just like in the roommate's case and a couple of the other cases where the defendants themselves required unlawfulness or developed unlawful content.
And here the assertion is that the design of those features, they were designed to facilitate illegal purchases. That's the wording of their
complaint. That is the theory of liability, but you can't point to a neutral tool and assert that as the basis for CDA liability. You have to show material contribution to unlawful content. And that's where we are in this case.
Counsel, petitioner says that these functions were developed for the express purpose of facilitating illegal sales. What do we do with that? This allows legal sales, but they say, well, this is what they were trying to accomplish. They were trying to corner, or they were trying to get access to the illegal arms market, and they designed this for the specific purpose of facilitating those illegal sales. What do we do with that allegation?
I see that my red light is on. May I answer?
You may answer that question. Yes.
We're here on a motion to dismiss, so let's take it as true, as we have to. Intent does not come into the analysis. There is no good faith requirement for immunity under the CDA. A particular type of intent is neither a condition of the immunity nor an exception to its applicability under the plain language of the statute. And in addition to that, in common law of tort, we need more than intent. We also need a duty to have been violated. And here the duty arises solely out of the fact that ArmsList is dealing in information that the plaintiff considers dangerous. That is classic publisher liability under the CDA.
Thank you very much.
May it please the Court and Chief Justice Jonathan Lowy for the plaintiff respondent, Yasmin Daniel, on behalf of herself and the estate of her mother, Zena Daniel Houghton. The CDA provides no basis to dismiss this case, and that is based on the plain language of Section 230. The plain language of Section 230, as Congress wrote it, is where the analysis should begin and where it probably should end, perhaps also applying rules of statutory construction, such as those laid out in Justice Scalia and Brian Garner's book, Reading Law. And I want to begin then with the relevant provision.
Begin with what? Make sure you speak
I'm sorry, the relevant provision, Section 230C1, and it states that no provider or user of an interactive computer system, service, essentially a website, shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. So what that says essentially is ArmsList shall not be treated as the publisher of third-party posts on their website. Some of the justices have pointed out already, that is not what we claim. And I was going to point to paragraphs 54 and 63 in the complaint, which lay this out. And it explains how ArmsList engaged in conduct and produced content, its own content.
What was its own content? Can you please tell me? what it was?
Certainly. Among other things, Arms List drafted a terms of service. And part of that, and they put this in capital letters, was a statement, I'm paraphrasing, but that they would not investigate any illegal conduct. That was, Arms List wrote that. They posted it on their website. It was basically a statement to illegal gun buyers and sellers that this website is a safe place where no one will bother you.
Isn't that the usual thing for an interactive site like this? That they, I mean, I know there's been some rumblings about trying to get Facebook and a few other things that use interactive sites, and all of them do the mea culpa. If there's anything illegal, it's not me, and I'm not going to be responsible for it, essentially.
Well,
that's content, as far as you're concerned.
Well, that certainly is content. It may be something that other websites do, but there's no question it is content created by Arms List.
But that content is not what you're complaining about. You're complaining about the posting of guns for sale by a private person who doesn't have to check on background matters.
With all due respect, Your Honor, that is a fact in the case, but that is not, and I want to be perfectly clear about it, that is not a basis of liability in this case. And let me give you an example which can explain how that is the case.
Okay.
We could have, and this is an analogy, Arms List could have done everything we allege that they do, that we base liability on. Saw a market opportunity to sell guns, broker gun sales to illegal purchasers, a way to make money off that. Designed a website with a terms of service saying this is a safe space, we're not going to investigate illegal sales. Created a data field, which is more content, that would enable private sellers, that is people who will not do a background check, to identify themselves as that. So an appealing aspect for illegal buyers like Radcliffe Houghton. They developed a search function so that somebody like Houghton, who was prohibited from legally buying guns, could search only for private sellers.
Counsel, let me pose a hypothetical to you. Let's say that Arms List created its website exactly as it exists, but nobody posted any ads whatsoever, buying or selling. Would there be any liability?
Well, as I understand the hypothetical, Your Honor, there would be no injury. So if there's no injury, there's no case. So you need to have all aspects. However, what I was getting...
You need to have an ad, right? Without an ad, there is no liability.
If I could finish... I think my hypothetical that I was getting at, perhaps too long-winded, was going to get at that, Your Honor. And that is that Arms List could do everything we allege and then partner with another company whose job would be to maintain the website and publish the ads. Same fact pattern happens. Now, in that case, we could sue Arms List as being a causal factor engaged in negligence, even aided and abetted unlawful conduct, and was a causal factor of the harm. Arms List certainly would not be treated as a publisher of a third-party post because it didn't publish third-party post, in my hypothetical. Its partner published the third-party post. We would have the same liability. The website that the company that runs the website may also be a defendant, may also be a cause, but that certainly doesn't exculpate Arms List. And that is the way we plead our case in the complaint. We do not rely on the fact that Arms List published the ad. Now, if my hypothetical is correct, and I believe it is, then the fact that under these fact patterns, Arms List did all those negligent acts that was a legal cause of this injury, yet in these facts, Arms List did even more. It published the ad. That cannot be a basis to exculpate Arms List from liability, particularly where we are not relying on the fact that they published the ad. We're not saying they're liable because they published the ad. And I do think that the facts about their design of the website, the content that they themselves, Arms List, put on the website, is very important because that means that the material contribution test is not really applicable to this case.
I'm sorry, but I disagree with you, because you, without the ad, going into Justice Bradley's question, without the ad from which the gun was purchased from Mr. Lynn, you wouldn't have a case. So you basically have to have that ad and publication of it.
In order for the injury to happen, it may be that one of the, it certainly is, one of the but-for causes were a number of things. Radcliffe Houghton firing the gun, Lynn selling the gun, the ad being posted. All of those are additional causal factors of this injury. However, that is not the basis of liability in this case. And I think we've got to, we should step back and decide and look at the context of this statute.
Are you making the distinction here between causation and your theory of liability then?
Yes. And I think that these lines can be muddied a bit, but the issue here is not whether we state claims under Wisconsin law. It's assumed for matters of this appeal right now that we do state claims under Wisconsin law. The only issue before this court on this appeal is, has Congress deprived Wisconsin of the authority to apply its law in this case? And that, by the way, is a heavy burden that it must meet, that Armsless must meet, given the presumption against preemption and principles of federalism that are protective of state sovereignty. And so to decide whether there is immunity, that is, whether Wisconsin no longer has the authority to apply its own law in this case, one has to look at the statute, 230C1, carefully and not expansively. And it's important also to look at the context of the statute. 230C2, just the next provision, says that no provider or user of essentially a website shall be held liable on account of, and then it explains basically if you block or screen offensive content, which, by the way, was the whole purpose of this statute, to encourage that. But if you do that, you shall not be liable. Congress pointedly did not include C1, the provision here,
Counsel,
into
the Court
that.
Of Appeals in its decision said, and I'm quoting, the Act does not protect a website operator from liability that arises from facilitating user activity. Do you agree with that statement in the Court of Appeals opinion?
Yes. I think what the CDA does, C1, the only provision we're talking about, all it does is exactly what it says, which is you cannot treat a website as a publisher of third-party content. That's what Congress said. That's what Congress meant. And by the way, the legislative history, which is not in dispute, is that the reason that this was drafted and enacted was to overrule the Stratton-Oakmont case in which a website tried to screen some offensive conduct, did a good deed, and the court held it as a publisher.
Doesn't just about every website facilitate user activity?
Well, Your Honor, the question is for liability. Did Armsless engage in tortious conduct? That's not an issue for this appeal, because that's a question of Wisconsin substantive law will be decided in another day. And I think it was Justice Kelly, Your Honor, who was asking about neutral tools. And I think it's very important to know that to distinguish cases where Twitter, Facebook, Google have actual neutral tools. They're just meant for anyone to search anything and anyone to communicate about anything. And courts have found you're not liable for that if your tools are actually neutral. Justice Kelly, as you stated, the allegation here is not that they were neutral tools. They were designed for a particular purpose, and it was not simply the intent that was not neutral. It was the actual conduct and content that was not neutral.
Do you concede that arms list facilitates lawful gun transactions?
Absolutely. And you can be a gun seller, or you can be any sort of business and do things lawfully and also do things unlawfully negligently, and you can still be liable for the negligence or unlawful conduct.
Then how are the tools not neutral on its website?
Every allegation that we have in paragraph 54 and 63 were decisions by arms list where it could have gone in two different directions, and it decided to go in the direction of facilitating criminal sales. There's nothing neutral about identifying sellers as private sellers.
Wait a minute. Why is that not neutral?
Well, the neutral thing would be a search like you would have in Google where you put in whatever terms you want. It was arms list who made the decision. We think it's important. We arms list think it's important to categorize in this way.
Right.
And the
if you're going to analogize that to the roommate's case, the thing that the roommate's case was doing was unlawful in and of itself, right?
Yeah.
So this is not unlawful. It's not unlawful to identify a private seller, is it?
No, Your Honor, but ours is a negligence case. One reason lawfulness was particularly significant in roommates was because the allegation was illegality. It was not a negligence case.
Right. So here you're alleging that they did this, they designed this for the specific purpose of facilitating illegal transactions, right? That's what you're saying. Now, I don't know that you can back off from that and say, well, you know, identifying a seller, you know, that's not illegal, and so that's, you know, so that it doesn't fall into the roommate's category. It's either neutral or it's not, right? And the neutrality is about whether you are facilitating an illegal transaction. Isn't that right?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, the question would be whether it's negligent, because that's the standard here. But there's a number of aspects that are not neutral. They made a decision that you could flag overpriced guns, but you could not flag illegal conduct.
What's the illegal conduct that you couldn't flag?
If somebody was illegally buying or selling guns.
How would you know that?
Well, for example, actually in this case, Radcliffe Houghton contacted another seller, and we allege this, and he was selling an assault rifle, and he thought that Houghton was up to something likely criminal. Because of arms list design, there was no way for him to flag illegal conduct. That was before the shooting took place. But there's many other aspects. There's the fact that there's no registration. There's no authentication. And
there aren't a lot of places where guns are bought and sold, all of those things that you're asking for. But they're not present.
But, Your Honor, the question here is, those are relevant questions for determining whether we have a negligence action under Wisconsin law.
No, I don't agree with you. I think they're relevant questions to whether or not arms list either created or developed information. That's what I think it is.
Well, Your Honor, we do point out, for example, and these are allegations that must be taken as true, that gunbroker.com and other websites sell guns online. Gunbroker.com is an auction site. It's involved in private gun sales.
I don't think that has anything to do, counsel, with all due respect, with the because we're not, you may want to argue that if you get your case to go to court and that other people have taken precautions. I don't think it falls within the statute, and I'm mostly concerned about F3, and I think I asked opposing counsel about exactly the same thing. I find the word development the most troublesome. I don't think anybody could argue that arms list actually created the particular ad that caused this gun to be sold. It was obviously created by Mr. Lynn. His gun, his price, right?
That is correct, Your
okay,
Honor.
Okay, so the word development is what bothers me, and that's why I've searched cases to try to figure out what does that mean within the statute? What did Congress have in mind when they used that term? I think it has to mean something different than created.
But, Your Honor,
otherwise they wouldn't have or between them, hopefully.
There are two basic aspects of liability for Arms List that are not shielded under the CDA. One of them is their role in materially contributing to developing content of others. That is one, but that's not our focus. Our focus is conduct and content by Arms List, which is independent of the third-party posts.
Is it also independent of the design of the website?
Design is one aspect of that, and there's absolutely nothing in Section 230.
So you need the design to be a subject that falls outside the CDA, correct?
There's no question about it, Your Honor. I mean, the CDA is very limited. The question is,
There is a question about it, Counselor. We wouldn't be here.
Well, but the language is very simple. It says that Arms List can't be treated as a publisher of third-party content. And I don't see how one can read that language and find that designing a website, creating code, posting a terms of service, creating data fields for private sellers, creating search fields for private sellers, none of that involves treating Arms List as a publisher of third party. It all predates the third party post. In fact, doesn't have to even involve the third party post.
Thank you, Counsel. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But you could say that about any website, and if illegal activity occurs that the website has facilitated, as I understand your argument, you're asking the state of Wisconsin to buck every other jurisdiction except arguably the state of Washington and maybe the Ninth Circuit, although I think that's a stretch. You're asking us to establish a rule that would find websites that facilitate illegal activity to be liable for the consequences of that activity.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, not at all. Because the one thing is, the issue in this case is not whether Arms List is liable under Wisconsin law. That's not an issue on appeal. The only issue is who gets to decide whether Arms List can be held liable. And Arms List argues Congress has decided it. We argue, no, we're outside of the 230. Wisconsin gets to decide. Now, at a later date, I expect there would be a motion for summary judgment. I think all these arguments saying Arms List should not be liable, it'd be a stretch of Wisconsin law. All these arguments can be made. And
that's,
it's up to Wisconsin courts
today,
to...
We're not here for those arguments today. We're here for whether the CDA shut your claim down.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. That is the only issue, and that's why you go back to the plain language.
Yeah, so, Counsel, let me just step you back for just a moment. I think you had an intriguing rubric within which to consider this. So you said, look, the way to look at this is, let's separate this out into two companies that are doing this, right? One company is doing one thing, one company is doing another. I didn't quite follow what the division was between the two. Could you say that again?
Sure. Arms List does the creating of the website, creates the data fields, creates the terms of service, everything we allege in paragraph 54, yeah. Creates it so it's attractive to illegal buyers and illegal sellers. Then they have nothing to do with who maintains and publishes the posts. Somebody else maintains the website and is charged with publishing the posts.
I'm not sure I understand the division between those two. If you're the one who has developed the website architecture, the search functions, all of that, right? Aren't you also the person that what is the difference between that and maintaining it?
I could hire Arms List. I could go to Arms List and I could say, I want a website that attracts illegal gun sales, and can you develop one for me? And they do, and then I'm the one who is maintaining the website and publishing the posts.
So you would get a, I just want to make sure I understand your example here. So you hire somebody to code the website.
That's one scenario, another is a partnership. Either one the same.
One party codes the website, right? And then another party comes along and says, okay, I'm going to buy that website that you coded, and then I'm going to use it, yeah? Is that kind of the distinction you're making?
I mean, those are the roles. I mean, it could be a partnership between the two, or it could be a contractor, either way. But right. That's the roles, yes,
okay.
Your Honor.
So now, let's say that there is that distinction, right? We divide it between Company A and Company B. Company A is the coder. They develop the structure of the website. and then they license that, let's say, to ArmsList. ArmsList runs it, and they profit from it, and so on. And then this injury occurs. If that is an actionable injury, could you prevail by a lawsuit just against Party A, Company A? Or do you need to get Company B liable as well?
Which one was the publisher? Yeah.
So Company A is the coder. So let's call it Coder and ArmsList. So the coder company develops the website and then leases it, rents it, whatever the transaction might be, to ArmsList. And ArmsList monitors it. They get the revenue and all that from running it. So now this occurs, right? To be successful, do you have to establish the liability of both Coder Company and ArmsList?
No. I mean, they're clearly, this is in the pattern jury instructions in Wisconsin. There can be a number of causes of harm, and you could have one of those causes of harm in the link could have immunity, or could be, you don't have to sue them all, in fact. That happens in quite a number of cases. There are cases where gun dealers are sued for negligently selling guns, and in some of those cases, the shooter is not sued. A straw purchaser may not be sued. Those are certainly important causal links to the harm, but you don't have to have them all before the court as part of your case, and you certainly don't have to be able to recover against all of them as a matter of Wisconsin common law.
Counsel, just for clarification, we're talking now about Coder and then maybe traditional publishing, something like that. Perhaps not. But as I understand your argument, it isn't just that it was an everyday average garden variety coder, but rather it was designed to facilitate illegal purchases.
That's exactly right, and that, I believe, was Justice Kelly's question earlier, and that's why I would distinguish between the neutral tools case and what this case is. I mean, one example is one neutral tool case was Fields v. Twitter. It was some terrorists who used Twitter, and a victim of terrorism said, well, Twitter's to blame because the terrorists used Twitter. And the court said, no, that's a neutral tool. They're not at fault. Now, the facts could be very different if Twitter was designed in a way where it wasn't Twitter, it was, helpingterrorists.com, and there were different aspects of content and coding and design that was all facilitating those in terrorist conduct.
To the plain language where we should be starting from. Hmm? Backward turn, backward, oh, time looks like. So why, looking at this language, and we are looking primarily at C1, and in part the shall be treated as phrase, but walk me through your plain language interpretation and append to it, after you give me your plain language interpretation, who we're talking about, Lynn, Radcliffe, is that the name of the other?
Yeah, the shooter.
Radcliffe, ArmsList. So give me your plain language interpretation and then put the names in it.
Certainly. Okay. The plain language interpretation is exactly what it says, that a website, a website, Your Honor, shall not be treated as a publisher of third-party content. So in this case, it would be ArmsList shall not be treated as...
I'm sorry for interrupting you, but what does no provider of an interactive computer service mean, and who does it refer to in this case?
That means ArmsList, and we concede that. And just to make the English plainer, I'd make the sentence a negative, and I would say I read it as ArmsList shall not be treated as the publisher of Lynn's post, his gun for sale post. And so therefore, if our claim was based on the basis of liability, not the basis of what caused the harm, or was one cause of harm, the basis of liability, if we said Armsless is liable because they published a Lynn's gun sale post, we would get rightly dismissed as barred by the CDA. But that is not what our allegations are.
Your allegation, in a nutshell, if I can put it this way, and I'm looking at page 37 of your brief, it's that it was foreseeable to Armsless that the design features that you've been talking about, and I'm quoting, would attract persons who are prohibited from legally buying guns and cannot pass a background check. But it's also foreseeable to all manner of social media providers, I'll use Facebook as an example, that people will use it to defame others. They will use it to coordinate criminal activity. They will use it to threaten other people. Facebook knows that because it's been done and it continues to be done. Should we also hold Facebook liable because it's on alert? It is foreseeable to them that others will use its design features to commit unlawful activity.
No, the CDA would not allow that liability.
Why?
Because in those cases, the basis of liability is that those companies, Facebook, Twitter, published third-party conduct. They published defamatory content, and CDA is saying, we're not going to allow liability for that because we want to allow for a vibrant internet where people can post things. However, there's nothing in C1 that says that if you do things other than publishing third-party content,
I'm getting to the design features of Facebook because that's what I understand your claim is based on. It's based on the design features of Armsless. I don't see how, if we were to adopt the rule that you're asking us to adopt, I don't see how the CDA would protect Facebook or Twitter or any other website or interactive service provider. I don't see how they could escape liability because it's not about, you're saying it's not about what third-party users put on the website. It's the design features, and Facebook has those design features too. And there could be unlawful gun transactions facilitated based on the design features of Facebook and Twitter, too. They've got private messaging that could go back and forth. So how is it that there is a limiting principle to the ruling that you're asking this court to make?
The limiting principle, there are two. One is the plain language of 230C1, and the other is Wisconsin law. We are not seeking any expansion of Wisconsin common law. Today, if Kohl's does something negligent or something that could constitute product liability, you can sue Kohl's. What Armsless is arguing is that if, and I'm not, I love Kohl's as a matter of fact, but what they're saying is if a negligent actor that could be liable under Wisconsin law, if they had a warehouse, an illegal gun sales warehouse in Milwaukee, if they take their operations online onto the internet, they have immunity. And Wisconsin, Armsless says, is not allowed to apply its common law principles just because it's no longer illegal gun warehouse in Milwaukee. It becomes illegalgunwarehouse.com. They get immunity. It was Armsless that's asking for an expansion of the law. And Your Honor, I see my red lights.
Your red light is on, counsel. But before you sit down, I wonder if Attorney Brett Erickson is here. Would you please come to the podium? My notes tell me, which I read after counsel started his argument, that you're not licensed to practice law in the state of Wisconsin. Sometimes when people come with the notation that they're pro hac vice, they've already been admitted by a Wisconsin court. So my first question to you, counsel, is have you been admitted by a Wisconsin court in this matter?
In this matter, I believe
the answer is
I
yes.
Have. Yes, Your Honor.
He has been. All right, very good. And you were supposed to introduce him to me and to give me that information. So I appreciate your being present. I'm sorry I didn't read the note. I was going to give you proactive Pro Hoc Vice. So certainly we enjoyed your argument very much, and thank you for appearing.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Rebuttal?
Respectfully, the question in this case is not who gets to decide whether Daniel's claim goes forward. I'm pretty sure this court is going to decide that either way. My colleague conceded that we're not really talking about content creation here, that without the ad in this case, there is no harm and therefore no liability. And that these
Counsel,
tools...
Counsel, isn't it true in every single one of these cases there's some harm? Every single one of the cases we've read, there's someone doing something on Roommates or Backpage. You've got to have that. I think that's the only connection that he was saying. You're not going to be standing here if there's no harm. Right?
That's fine. The allegation here is that the design and operational features of the website contributed to that harm and brought it about. The first thing that we heard on that point was that the CDA doesn't actually extend to the design and operational features of the website. That would require this court to jettison a whole body of CDA law. But even setting that aside, my colleague also conceded that these tools have lawful issues, lawful uses. And so what this really comes down to is we're getting hung up on different definitions of neutrality. The case law tells us what neutrality means. Tools are neutral as long as users ultimately determine what content to search for or post.
Counsel, what about Mr. Lowy's paradigm in which you have Coder Company and Arms List and Coder Company develop? This is a demonstration. This is not about the content. Arms List, they're managing the content, whatever. Coder Company, though, Coder Company built some functions that are contributed to the tragedy that took place in this case. And we're trying to get after Coder Company, right? So does the CDA cover that?
Certainly, because that coder would be the provider of an interactive computer service. It created it.
So, but he says, but you know what? The way they did it is itself negligent, at least negligent. Right. So, and it's not negligent with respect to any particular ad that eventually got posted on the system. It's just negligent in design. Is that covered by the CDA?
That's protected by the CDA. Or rather, I should say, claims of that type are barred by the CDA. Mm-hmm. Case law is plain that simply providing neutral tools, whether negligent or not, cannot become the basis of a state law civil tort claim. If they treat the defendant as the publisher or speaker of the third-party content. And here, there's no way to state that claim without getting back to the third-party content in some way, which was the point that I raised. Now, neutrality does not mean making choices that aren't as safe as other choices that the defendant could have made. It doesn't mean making choices that skew in a certain policy direction that is at odds with the policy direction the plaintiff prefers. Neutrality is defined in the case law to mean if you provide tools with lawful and unlawful uses and someone abuses them, you're not liable. And just to point to a couple of cases on that point, one is Goddard versus Google. It's a Northern District of California case from 2009. And another is Herrick versus Grindr, a Southern District of New York case from 2018, both of which were cited. At least the Herrick case was cited in the Court of Appeals opinion.
Counsel, I want to look again at the JS case that was referred to. And in paragraph 13, it says this. It is important to ascertain whether, in fact, Backpage designed its posting rules to induce sex trafficking to determine whether Backpage is subject to suit under the CDA because, quote, a website helps to develop unlawful content and thus falls within the exception to Section 230 if it contributes materially to the alleged illegality of the conduct. Why isn't that the situation we have here?
Because material contribution in the CDA case law means requiring unlawful content, like the roommate's case, where the form built by the developer required the user, as a condition of use, to input information that was per se discriminatory. Here we have a different case because the forms and search functions that are described by the plaintiff in that paragraph we've been discussing are neutral tools. They have lawful and unlawful uses. They don't inherently require illegality, which is what material contribution means in this context. I see my red light is on. We would ask the court to reverse the Court of Appeals and maintain that these claims should remain dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you both for very good reason. I don't know if any of the amicus writers are here. We had just a pile of amicus briefs in this case, and they were excellent as well. So I want to thank you all. This is obviously an interesting case to all of us and a very important case in this day and age in which we live for a variety of reasons. So thank you very much. We will adjourn now, and the court will meet in closed conference at 3:10. We are adjourned.